And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'm pleased to welcome Hampton Sides to the program today. Hampton is a veteran journalist and nonfiction writer, with his work appearing in National Geographic and Outside Magazine. Book Talk listeners may best know him for his appearances discussing titles like Hellhound on His Trail, Blood and Thunder, and In the Kingdom of Ice. Today, we will begin the first of a two-part interview talking about his latest book, The Wide, Wide Sea, Imperial Ambition, First Contact, and the Fateful Final Voyage of Captain James Cook, which is published by Doubleday. Hampton, Captain James Cook wasn't always a captain. What was his rise up through the ranks like?
Well, it was rather meteoric, but starting from nothing. He grew up in Yorkshire. He was the son of a farm manager. He envisioned a life very similar to that for himself at first. It was kind of hard in that time and that place to make your fortune. You know, it was a pretty stratified society in England in that day. The legend is that he, one day when he was 7 years old, he climbed to the top of this short mountain or very large hill in the moors of Yorkshire. And for the first time, he caught a glimpse of the ocean. And he said, "That's where I want to go. What is that?" Of course, he'd heard about it, but it was about 15 miles away, and he just hadn't seen it. So he very quickly moved to a little place called Whitby on the North Sea coast, a shipping town, a town that was famous for building ships and also moving coal from Newcastle down to London, Quaker-run businesses, and he apprenticed for one of these shipbuilders. And he found his calling in a hurry. He was self-taught. He worked his way very quickly up through the ranks of the merchant marine and then decided to join the Royal Navy, where he, again, worked his way up from nothing, basically an able-bodied seaman, to much higher ranks very quickly, primarily because he was exceptionally good at navigating and moving these small ships, these Whitby cats, as they were called, that were designed for hauling coal. You know, basically treacherous seas there, very dangerous waters. And he was very good at moving these boats around and charting the coastline, mapping the coastline, and also turned out very, very good at astronomy. And these are skills that all played into what became his ultimate strong suit, which was making maps, very, very, very accurate maps. And the Admiralty took note of this. This young man had some kind of supernatural talent for mapping places based on little more than dead reckoning and trigonometry. And, you know, they didn't have tools like they have today in surveying coastlines. So he was involved in the what we call the French and Indian War, but that is also known as the Seven-Year War in Canada, where he charted the entire coastline of the St. Lawrence Seaway, was involved in some of the key battles in that war at Quebec City. And then they gave him this plum assignment of mapping the entire coast of Newfoundland, which is, if you've ever seen it on a map, Newfoundland is an incredibly intricate coastline, you know, gouged by glaciers. And if you take his map, which he did over three seasons, and superimpose a satellite image of Newfoundland, it is chillingly, chillingly accurate. It's unbelievable. It's like, how did he do it? That map that he did of Newfoundland became like the definitive map for something like 100 years. But then this was the golden age of exploration, and he was offered this plum assignment of being the captain of this first voyage around the world. They went to Tahiti. They went looking for this massive supercontinent that supposedly existed in the southern hemisphere somewhere, which he did not find. But he returned to England from this first voyage, and he became a celebrity. He became a star, and he was offered a second voyage, and then finally a third voyage. I think, you know, you can say he's one of, certainly in terms of the sheer nautical miles that he traveled and all the places he stumbled upon, all the cultures that he encountered, he was one of the greatest explorers of all time, and certainly one of the most consequential explorers of all time. So that's his background. It comes from modest means in Yorkshire and somehow makes his way nearly to the very top.
To overcome kind of a class-based society, such as Britain was at the time.
Exactly.
To do that, his skills must have been phenomenal.
Yes. I think, you know, most people who were high-ranking officers in the Royal Navy had connections. They had money. They had a family name. They had something. He did it by sheer, like, ferocious hard work, ferocious competence, which is great. I love those kinds of stories because they are pretty few and far between in those times, especially.
It seems like that would lead a man to not be comfortable with downtime.
Yes, he was a workaholic for sure. He was not Quaker, but he had trained under these Quakers, and he had a lot of their values, frugality, hard work, an aversion to ostentatious clothes and anything. He dressed very simply. He ate very simply. He was very modest. One of the cool things about Cook is that in all of his travels around the world, he never once named a single thing, a feature or a bay or a mountain, after himself or any member of his family. And that's modesty. I mean, that's the kind of modesty I'm talking about. There are things named after Cook all over the world, but they were named by the Admiralty, not by himself. That kind of modesty is part of the culture of Quaker life, and I think it is something that he imbibed.
So do you think it was this association with the Quakers early on that gave him a positive model for his managerial style when he was a captain?
I think so. You know, one of his other skills was shipboard economy. Running a ship was like such a complicated endeavor on these long voyages. And the Quakers are famously frugal and organized and very serious-minded, sober-minded people, right? There was a reason why they were so prominent in the whaling industry at that time. They knew how to balance a checkbook. They were very tight and very organized, and so was he.
And they weren't oriented toward violence, and so I think that gave him a level head in first contact encounters.
Yeah, I think, you know, when he was given an opportunity to be on an exploration ship as opposed to a military, you know, warship, he jumped at that opportunity because I think he was a peaceful guy. He was a very cerebral person. What he loved most was what he was best at, which was making maps and charting places that had never been mapped before and trying to understand complicated coastlines and getting it down on paper and using all the tools and the mathematics behind that to construct these maps, what became really the first definitive maps of the Pacific Ocean, which had not been very thoroughly explored. But the Quaker thing and I don't want to say he was a lover, not a fighter, because he certainly was actively involved in the French and Indian War. But he much preferred these other assignments that took him to the other side of the world to do more peaceful kinds of work.
Now, you bring up love. He was married, and it must have been very tough on his family for all of his long absences.
It was. So he was married to a woman named Elizabeth, who was, I've forgotten now, maybe a dozen years his junior. They had a number of kids. He would come ashore. Seems like she'd be pregnant very quickly. And he had this growing family, but he hardly knew his kids because he was always out at sea. And frankly, after a few months of coming back home, he was restless. He didn't know what to do with himself. And this was true of a lot of these long-distance voyagers. Even though these voyages were very strenuous and arduous and, you know, bad food and horrible smells and tight quarters, these guys would, as soon as they got home, they wanted to go back out on the ocean again. It was addictive. It was strangely addictive. And he always wanted to get back out there. I think he also, you know, just as often happens with sailors, you know, just the rhythms of life on these ships, the work that is involved, the kind of protocols and kind of the hierarchies. It's kind of a predictable life in some ways. I mean, yes, there are storms. Yes, there are things that crop up. But otherwise, there's a rhythm to seaboard life that I think he enjoyed and thrived in.
Now, it's incredible enough that he's one of the major cartographers of his time. But as you said, he was also talented in astronomy and also learned captaining a ship was something that just seemed to be second nature to him. There's not many people out in the world that are so accomplished in three fields.
Yes. And, you know, all the accounts, all the people who served under him, even if they didn't like him, they respected him, you know, master and commander. He was one of those guys that could spot danger, could smell danger. He was looking after the welfare of his men and his ship at all times. He was a big, tall guy. He was quite imposing.
You said 6'3"?
Yeah, 6'3", they think. He had a ferocious temper. If he got mad at you, watch out. You know, he had an eagle eye. He spotted some little small problem way up in the rigging, you know, and boy, he wanted it corrected quickly. And so he was an intimidating guy, severe. You've seen the portraits of him. He had a gaze that could just bore right through you. So, you know, like I say, a lot of people didn't necessarily like him, but they respected him and admired his abilities and were not only willing to serve under him, but they kept coming back for more and more and more. There are many men who served on all three of his voyages.
Now, what was the goal of the second voyage?
Second voyage was primarily intended to go back down to the southern hemisphere and look more in a more organized fashion for this supercontinent. It was believed by the scientists of the day that there had to be an enormous landmass somewhere at the bottom of the world, much larger than what we now know to be Antarctica or Australia. It's kind of wacky science, but they believe that there had to be this landmass down there to counterbalance the preponderance of landmasses in the northern hemisphere, or otherwise the planet would be wobbly and top-heavy and would spin out into outer space, basically. Crazy.
A lot of people had the hollow Earth theory back then, so they didn't know that there was nickel and iron molten at the middle of the planet.
Yeah, yeah. Who knows, though, what really where this all came from, but it had been fixed on some early maps, like Mercator maps and things like this. Terra Australis Incognita, the unknown supercontinent. People have been looking for it. And, you know, the English scientists and particularly people associated with the Royal Society really wanted to find it because they believed that there must be people down there and there must be great trade. And this was kind of like the last new world you could find. Well, on the second voyage, somewhat on the first voyage, but on his second voyage, he really looked for it. And he made multiple sort of dagger thrusts southward, almost reaching Antarctica. He didn't quite make it to Antarctica, but he kind of sensed its presence because of all the icebergs and the bird life that he saw. But he never found the supercontinent, and he decided that it was a fiction, a fantasy, and he dashed the hopes and dreams of a lot of people back in England who had built their careers on this concept. So he became what they call a hero of negative discovery. He didn't find something that was widely presumed to be in existence. He was right, of course. Australia is quite a big place. Antarctica is quite big, but it was nothing like this massive continent. It was supposed to be larger than North America. He didn't find it. And along the way, a number of other really amazing things happened on that voyage, including another negative, I guess you would say, and that is no one developed scurvy, which was widely presumed to be a kind of occupational hazard of a long voyage. If you go more than a couple of hundred days, people would start dropping like flies from this horrible, horrible malady. But on Cook's first and then even longer second voyage, no one died of scurvy. So he was hailed as a hero for that. They thought he had conquered scurvy, which he really hadn't, but he did have a regimen that worked, which was making his men eat fresh vegetables and fresh fruit and fresh meat whenever they could find it, get off that horrible diet of hardtack biscuits and salt pork. It worked. He saved a lot of men's lives, and the Crown started to realize, and the Admiralty started to realize, hey, we can send men out on these long, long, long voyages, extend the reach of the empire, and no one will die of scurvy. So for those two reasons, he was hailed as a hero. All that salt is very bad for you. And sailors are weird about this. They like routine. They like predictable things. They fell in love with that kind of food. They didn't want to eat this food that Cook made them eat, like greens and birch beer. And it was always experimenting with weird foods that they thought, oh, this is terrible. I want to get back to those basically ham and biscuits and, you know, jerky and salt and vinegar. But he basically forced this stuff down their throats, and it probably saved their lives.
And he probably wasn't a super taster because he was very enthusiastic about trying all the local cuisines.
Yeah, he was famous for, you know, having an iron stomach. He would eat anything. He would try anything. He thought it was rude if you're sitting down with a chief in Polynesia somewhere and they give you something and you don't eat it, whether it's dog or kava, which was widely consumed down there. And the chief would have like a lowly servant who would chew the kava with copious amounts of saliva, spit it into a cup, and then you would drink that. And Cook was happy to do it. He wanted to try and sample anything. He almost viewed it as his duty. You know, it's like, I'm down here to explore, to meet people, to understand their customs. I got to eat the food, too. It's food that many of his officers and his sailors turned their nose up at.
I wonder if he had read the essays of Michel de Montaigne, who was noted for being very open to other cultures and understanding that a lot of the things we do are just because we do them and not because they're inherently good or superior.
I don't know if he had read Montaigne, but he certainly viewed himself as an Enlightenment era explorer. By that, I mean the purpose of these explorations, of course, there's a subtext. Yes, it's to advance the empire and advance the crown. And he understood the chess game that was being played. But underneath that, or subsumed under all of that, was the idea that it is also to expand knowledge and to describe in a kind of objective, agnostic, proto-anthropological way, without judgment, the customs of the people that he was encountering. And so what you get in his descriptions, I wouldn't say he's an incredibly brilliant or engaging writer, but he's a very fair-minded observer. And he describes, you know, what they wear, what their spears look like, what their warfare implements are, you know, what their religious customs are. And he does not pass judgment, and he never, ever once tried to convert anyone to the Christian faith or talk about the superiority of England. I think he believed, like most officers of the day, in the sort of the technological superiority of Europe, but he was fascinated by these cultures and amazed especially by the Polynesians. And when he began to realize, because he eventually went everywhere in Polynesia, from Easter Island to New Zealand to Hawaii and Tonga, what we call the Polynesian Triangle, he started to realize these were the same people, and they had traveled over this huge distance with ships that didn't have nails. They didn't have rivets. How did they do it? He begins to get fascinated with the puzzle of Polynesia. How did they do these migrations? And he starts to understand that they must have been some of the greatest long-distance voyagers of all time. And this is something that the scholars today are really coming to understand, just the full extent of their diaspora. Cook was one of the first to begin to see it.
Now, you have a lengthy author's note at the beginning of the book talking about the way we have been reevaluating empire and first contacts around the world. And it seems Cook would have been very much in mind with modern thinking along those lines.
I think he would have. You know, one of the points I definitely have to make in the author's note is the caveat about discovery. Okay, the word discovery, we have for generations said people like Cook discovered this or that, you know, forgetting that there were people there already who had just already discovered it.
We need adjectives in front of that word.
Yeah, right. So I make the very clear, necessary, even though I think it's obvious, caveat that he was the first European discoverer in some of these places. He may have been the first discoverer of some uninhabited islands that he encountered along the way, but the Polynesians got there first, and they did it by virtue of some unbelievable navigation of their own kind. So that's important. That's one point. And another point is the concept of private property. Wherever Cook went, he was often encountering the problem of theft, right? These Polynesians especially were just obsessed with iron, anything metal, because they didn't really have it. Tools, hammers, awls, sextants, and quadrants just went missing all the time. And it drove him crazy. But the Polynesians had a very different concept of private property and ownership. And, you know, almost everything that in their society was communal ownership. They also thought, well, this metal stuff, it seems to come from the earth. You know, why be stingy with this substance that we should all have and share? So it's kind of an interesting cultural clash going on at every port where he anchors.
But it's also like they weren't not a warlike people. They had battles amongst the islands.
Of course they did.
And factions on the islands. What were the casus belli of those? I mean, was it limited resources that they fought over, or just you didn't like them?
For example, in Hawaii, when he makes it to the big island of Hawaii, there is a war going on between Hawaii and Maui that had been going on for a long time. I don't know if it really was about resources. I think it was just about control. I think it was also, you know,
Hatfield and McCoy's?
A little bit of Hatfield's and McCoy. You're sitting there on the west coast of Hawaii and you're looking over this other island, and it's like they're different over there. You know, it's the same culture, of course, but, you know, there were minor differences. And, you know, and I think warfare, unfortunately, is just part of human nature. And they were ferocious. And so were almost all the Polynesians, most especially the Maori of New Zealand. They were constantly warring with each other. I don't know really what it was all about. I'm not really a scholar of that, but it's something that Cook remarks upon. And everywhere he goes, he gets, you know, they try to bring him into these conflicts. You know, why don't you fight with us? You have these cool things called, you know, you call guns. You have muskets and cannons and things. Why don't you fight for us and we'll go take out the enemy over there on the other side of the bay? And he makes a very careful point of not enmeshing himself in these internecine conflicts, because he's got a larger mission. He's got to move on and try to explore something else. So, yeah, it's kind of an interesting thing that it's like everyone wants cook because he's got these guns. In fact, they want the guns. Like, please, just give us the guns and we'll do the fighting. He always refuses.
You say he may have proved to be the inspiration for Captain James Kirk of Star Trek fame. Mm-hmm. And so it seems like he had his own prime directive, as they say.
Yes, his prime directive. Yeah, that is true. Supposedly, Captain James Kirk of the USS Enterprise was patterned after Captain James Cook of the HMS Endeavor. That was his first ship on his first voyage. You know, some of the similarities, I mean, you know, there's an episodic quality to the way he went from island to island to island, and it was almost like he'd gone to another planet. The cultures changed, the people changed, the language changed a little bit, and he was always like trying to come in peace, but also be careful because you didn't know if these were peaceful people, but trying to be kind of scientific about it and always writing in his captain's log. So, I mean, there are a lot of similarities, although I sometimes thought that he was really more similar to Spock in the sense that he was pretty, and at least during his first two voyages, very kind of very rational, very cerebral, not very emotional. Other Spock-like qualities, he just... Yeah, he did have a temper that occasionally cropped up, but he was scientific and just kind of agnostic about everything that he did. So, yeah, there's some similarities there for sure. But, you know, in America, I think a lot of Americans get him mixed up with other captains. The Australians and the New Zealanders and certainly the English know about Captain Cook. But Americans, I think, get him mixed up with other captains, real and imaginary, like, you know, Captain Kidd, Captain Hook. I can't tell you how many people thought I was writing about this pirate guy from Peter Pan, Captain Hook.
Was it Dr. Hook in the Medicine Show? Was that the 70s
yeah.
band?
Yeah. Briefly, in the early days of McDonald's, there was a character called Captain Crook, who was always stealing with the Hamburglar. I think Captain Crook liked the fish sandwich. Anyway, Americans don't really know. They get him mixed up with other people. And, you know, Captain Cook was one of the great explorers in the pantheon of Magellan and Marco Polo and, you know, a handful of others, the great European explorers. And so I hope my book is able to kind of disabuse Americans of some of these falsehoods and, you know, realize whatever you think of the guy and his voyages, he was the real deal and someone that Americans should know more about.
There have been so many books written about Captain Cook over the 200 plus years since he made these voyages, but it seems that we do need that education once again.
Yeah, and most of those books have been written by Australian scholars, New Zealand scholars, and English scholars. Not very many of these books have been written about Americans, and the definitive biographer from New Zealand was a guy named J.C. Beaglehole. I love his name.
Did he ever study Darwin as well?
No, he didn't, because he ended up spending his entire life on nothing but Cook, annotating all of Cook's journals, all of Cook's officers' journals, and then finally writing the definitive biography. It took him 30 years to do it. It's about 1,000 pages. But I dare you to read it, though. It is long and dense and kind of a hagiography. And I think what's different about my book, one advantage of being an American is that I don't really have a dog in this fight. I don't have any of the baggage that I think a lot of English and Australian writers have. A lot of Australians used to view him as kind of a founding father, a guy in a wig, guy that's up there in a lot of statues, the guy who first mapped Eastern Australia and, you know, of course, it became a convict land where all the prisoners were taken. But now it's this huge society, and then they look back on him, or used to anyway, as one of their kind of founding father heroes. I don't have any of that as an American writer. I'm just writing about a guy who I'm able to be a little bit more objective about, but also a guy who interfaces with United States history a lot. Even though he was British, the purpose of his third voyage was to go to Alaska, what we, you know, now call the state of Alaska, and try to find a passage over Canada, what the famous Northwest Passage. And so a lot of the action of this book happens in present-day United States, Oregon, Washington, Alaska, and of course, Hawaii.
Did your previous book, In the Kingdom of Ice, is that one of the things that gave you some insight and desire to study Cook further?
Absolutely. Kingdom of Ice was about a voyage a century later, an American voyage to go to the North Pole based on some equally wacky science. They had this idea that there's warm water currents that would tunnel through the ice and get you to the North Pole, which was supposed to be a warm water basin Oh, the science was so wrong, and people had to suffer so terribly to prove that it was wrong. But this voyage, which was captained by an American, Captain George DeLong, the ship got stuck in the ice. And almost the exact same place where Captain Cook encountered ice a century earlier and nearly got stuck in the ice himself. And so, yeah, I remember when I was working on that book, I kept hearing about Cook's voyages up around there. And I always had thought, no, I thought Captain Cook was down in the South Seas, which he was, of course. But he also was in the Arctic. In fact, he just went just about everywhere from the Antarctic to the Arctic. And I filed that away and thought, you know, maybe I'll return to this. And, you know, it could be a good book about Cook's explorations in Alaska. So, yeah, that's kind of where the seed came from.
And it was just fascinating that at the time they believed that salt water couldn't freeze in Britain.
This was one of the theories that persisted for a long, long time. The idea was that salt water could never freeze. But, of course, there's ice up there. They knew that. And they thought, well, that is just ice that is discharged from rivers. So that if you can get away from the coastline and that ice discharged from rivers, get out into the way out into the open sea, you'll find your way through. There might be some stray ice, but you'll get there. And it's going to be smooth sailing to the North Pole or up and over Canada. Of course, the British had been for a long time obsessed with the idea of finding a shortcut over Canada that would connect the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific Ocean, cut off a lot of time and danger and risk that their ships had to face if they went, you know, all the way under South America or South Africa, because they wanted to get to the Orient. You know, they wanted to trade with China. So unbelievable numbers of expeditions had wormed their way into the eastern coast of Canada, Baffin Island, and looking for this Northwest Passage. Never went well. People basically froze to death and, you know, got stuck in the ice and starved, and they'd be eating shoe leather and they developed scurvy and just horrible, horrible stories. But this idea for the third voyage was, let's go try the whole thing, but in reverse. Let's go around to the Pacific side, what we now know as the Bering Strait, the Bering Sea, which was not part of the world that was well known at all. Only the Russians had made explorations on that side.
And at least bad among maps.
Yeah, and the maps that they had produced were either incompetently bad or they were deliberately bad. In other words, they were trying to fool the other European powers. You know, one of the maps shows this little island called Alaska. That's where it first appears on a map, Alaska. And it looks like a teeny little island, a little smaller than Ireland. It also shows a clear way up and over Canada, which they never even ventured that far. But, you know, it was a tantalizing map that Cook had to work with, but it would prove to be just cartoonishly wrong. And one of the things that Cook does on this voyage, and he does it very well, as you would expect, he gives us the real map of Alaska, what it really looks like. It's, again, just unbelievably accurate. How he does it in the fog, on heavy seas, many days where he just can't even see the coastline. Somehow he pulls this thing off, and it's quite accurate and quite amazing.
Well, Hampton, we haven't really even set launch on the journey proper. Will you come back next week and share the book some more with us?
Oh, sure. I'd love to. That sounds great. Let's do it.
Super. Hampton Sides is the author of The Wide, Wide Sea, Imperial Ambition, First Contact, and The Fateful Final Voyage of Captain James Cook, which is published by Doubleday. Join us next time as we conclude our conversation. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is produced in the studios of FM 89.3 WYPL Memphis, a service of the Memphis Public Library, a division of the City of Memphis. Book Talk is copyrighted by the Memphis Public Library, all rights reserved.